This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways to stay in touch with your union. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event or have any concern involving the union, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The upcoming 2020 census will be one of the most important in recent memory. The Trump administration is attempting to add a question regarding citizen status to the census, which many fear will reduce participation. The Supreme Court is expected any day to rule on the constitutionality of that question. Joining us in the studio to talk about the importance of participating in next year's census is New York City Central Labor Council Political Director Lucia Gomez. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a step back and talk about what the census is and what it accomplishes. Why is it important that there is a census, and what are the effects of having a census?
The decennial census, right? Well, the census itself is just a count of populations, right? The U.S. Department of Commerce has, in fact, a U.S. Census Bureau that conducts a decennial census. It's been happening since 1890, every 10 years. It is a pure population count, a one-to-one person to person fills out a survey, lets them know how many people live in their household, who's in the country. And that is by mandate of the U.S. Constitution that it is required to count everyone in the country on April 1st of that particular decennial year, any year ending in zero, right? So 1890 and now 2020.
What was the point of that? Do you know? I mean,
it's the apportionment of political representation at the congressional level. So we have 435 congressional seats that have to be apportioned across the seats. So depending on how many people live in a particular state, they get a certain allocation of congressional districts within that state. Each state then takes that same number and then allocates the number of state senate, state assembly seats, although those numbers are fixed, right? There's a fixed number of seats. We don't lose seats. What we lose in the state of New York in terms of state and local seats are where those seats are drawn, right? Geography, population shifts.
So that every district has a certain number, meaning a district represents X number of people.
That's right. And that number fluctuates based on the population that the decennial census indicates that we actually have in a particular state. For the last couple of decades that I've been participating in the census, so at least in 2000, I do recall my first census that I was active in, we lost two congressional representatives. At that time, it was 31. Then we lost two in 2010, which was 31. We went down to 29, and then we lost two. We were at 27. And so there is a possibility that the state of New York will once again lose two seats. If we lose, that means it's someone else's gain, right? So another state that has, in fact, grown in population will see the numbers, will see that increase in congressional revenue.
So that New York City, which is a large metropolis with millions of people, suffers to some extent because of what's happening population-wise upstate?
Aside from the population, right, which the decennial census is very specifically mandated by the Constitution to count, we actually allocate resources. Federal funding comes as a result of the numbers that you demonstrate are in your state as well. So there's over $70 billion in federal funding that comes into the state of New York that is, in fact, allocated based on the population that you have. So we have a combination of both political representation or your voice in Congress, which is a huge deal. We see what that means right now. And then you have tons of federal dollars. Now, in combination, those things are ridiculously impactful.
So you really do need to be stand up and be counted. I mean, if you're not, it's just
absolutely. I mean, it is the basic fundamental of our civic engagement is being counted in the U.S. Census.
So now What has Donald Trump done? What are they asking for?
So in 2018, there was a proposal to place a citizenship question in the U.S. Census form, something that was has not been seen since 1950. In 1950, it was, in fact, eliminated. There was a census question.
There was. I had no idea about
that. In 1950, there was a census question. For obvious reasons, I think the political climate and at that time, the potential misuse of data and what we saw fascist governments do at a particular point in time, there was elimination of that question. It wasn't necessary in order to actually exercise. Representation is based on the total number of people, not whether or not you're a citizen or not.
Right.
And so it was eliminated from the census form. It had never been it perhaps had been discussed in prior administrations, you know, maybe people talking about wanting to bring it back. But there was no real reason why it needed to come back. I mean, the Department of Justice, or their excuse was that the Department of Justice was claiming that it needed to, in order to count citizen voting age numbers for their redistricting, because there are states outside of this area that need to demonstrate a certain amount of numbers so that they can keep a certain threshold legally for how they redraw districts at the local level. In the state of New York, that is not the case. In many states across the country, it's not the case. And they really don't need those exact numbers. The problem here is that once you talked about putting a citizenship question, and we've seen the politics of this administration and where it was going, that in connection demonstrated that there was a willingness to begin to create an other category for anyone who was not a citizen. And so once we see those raw numbers of people that are not citizens, it doesn't ask you if you're undocumented. It just asks you if you're not a citizen. So are you a citizen? Not a citizen, right? It also asks you if you were naturalized and in what year, and whether you were born in Puerto Rico or the U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam. And so it asks you just so that they can make some kind of determination. Now, that same exact question is in other census surveys, not the decennial, not the one that is mandated by the Constitution, in other surveys. So they have a look at what the population is like, and that's how services get rendered in the federal from the federal level. So we're waiting now for the U.S. Supreme Court to let us know if they will, in fact, allow that census question to go into play. Many years go by where tests happen on specific questions. They can make
tests?
A change. Yes, the Census Bureau conducts tests in small counties, a sample size of the population, just to see how people would respond, to see whether or not it's scientifically viable. Let's be clear. The U.S. Census Bureau is a scientific agency. It counts. It is the most fundamental mathematical scientific unit.
It's also an awesome responsibility trying to count.
I mean, and we use those numbers for everything. People need to pay attention to how transportation resources come in, how many buses in a particular area, how many schools, how many hospitals. All those numbers that the Census Bureau provides lets us know where things need to grow, where things, housing needs to happen, where new banks need to come in. Businesses use census data, economic data, labor statistics data. I mean, it all gets used by all these agencies to figure out and factor in resources and programming.
We're talking with Lucia Gomez. She is the political director of the New York City Central Labor Council. What is the New York City Central Labor Council?
Oh, the Central Labor Council is a federation of labor organizations throughout the city of New York. We're one of numerous labor councils throughout the country, part of the American Federation, the AFL-CIO. And so,
which we were a part of, DC 37.
That's right. DC 37 is a part of the AFL-CIO. It's also affiliated with the New York City Central Labor Council and the New York State AFL-CIO. So there's a state federation. But the New York City Central Labor Council is the largest labor council of the country. The density in the city of New York of labor members, of union member and union households, is huge.
We've just got a few minutes left. I just want to ask, this decision by the Supreme Court will affect the way labor in New York State thinks about dealing with the census? I mean, what are our goals as we move forward into 2020? We want to make sure everybody is counted.
We want to make sure everyone is counted, regardless of what the decision by the Supreme Court is, whether it's coming out tomorrow or it's coming out next week. At the end of the day, the labor movement is in solidarity with communities throughout the city of New York, throughout the state, throughout the country, that just ensures that everyone is counted, regardless if there's a citizenship question or not in the census form.
The concern, though, is that if there is a citizenship question, that is going to hinder or
It's going to cast a shadow on whether, you know, the intentions of the census and whether or not those numbers are going to be used for anything other than what we've just spoken about, political representation and economic resources into neighborhoods.
And why would we think that? It's only coming from the Trump administration.
Exactly. And so I think the climate does not allow for a real discussion about why that question should automatically be placed on the census. People are going to be like, well, why can't we count? I want to say I'm a U.S. citizen. And I think it's people's already, there's a lack of trust in government. And this comes from documented communities and undocumented communities across the board. I mean, there's a huge undercount in the city of New York from populations living in NYCHA facilities. People think that, and people who live in converted homes where, you know, there's multiple units in an apartment and in housing. I think people feel that this information is, in fact, going to be shared with other agencies, and it will not be. This information at that level, detailed information about an individual, does not get shared. It is, in fact, you know, illegal to share information, and it is fined over $250,000, over 10 years imprisonment. I mean, there is so much, you know, security measures around, you know, violating the law around sharing information that the data that we see is at a certain level that doesn't allow you to pinpoint who that person is. Right. It doesn't allow you to violate that person's individual
privacy. And folks have to understand
privacy.
That because otherwise they're going to think Big Brother is watching.
Right. That's from my perspective, to be honest, like I think the damage about whether or not people trust the census has already been done with the discourse about what the intentions were around the citizenship question. So whether it's in the form or not in the form, I think the PR, you know, the public relations around the census is very difficult going forward because someone's going to, you know, strict, you know, right. Go out and ask, is this secure? And, you know, folks like me and others in the labor movement, others that are trusted partners with our members are going to have to be honest and say, listen, yes, you can trust this census form. You know, it is protected under the law. And together we're going to get through the next couple of years to ensure that your, you know, individual privacy rights are not, in fact, violated.
I just want to make an announcement connected to this. The DC 37 Political Action Committee will continue. We've been holding citywide meetings on the importance of participating in the census. There's going to be a meeting on June 24th. That's in northern Manhattan. For the exact meeting location and time, please call the Political Action Department at 212-815-1550. We're talking with Lucia Gomez. She is the political director of the New York City Central Labor Council on the census. We've got about a minute left. What do you want to tell me about the future moving forward through this process?
You know, the labor movement is going to be critical to ensure that everyone in the city gets counted. I mean, the CLC represents over 1.3 million families, you know, members and their families throughout the city. But you add on that everyone that we have within our, you know, family units that is much larger,
sure.
Our neighbors, our friends. You know, I think the kind of security that as union members we have and we hold dear, we want to make sure that we assist our neighbors and our communities so that they get counted. This is not just about us as individuals, but about the, you know, the security of all our entire neighborhoods to make sure that they are all counted, because if we lose political representation, this is not just union members that lose.
That's
it.
Absolutely.
It's not just right them, you know, them like the community member. No, we're all in this together. And as labor members, we're so strongly part of the fabric of our neighborhoods that we need to become, you know, at the most fundamental level, actively involved in ensuring everyone gets counted. So
Lucia Gomez, the political director of the New York Central Labor Council. Thank you very much for talking about this. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. There was a story in The Chief, the civil service paper that's been around for a very long time, a very disturbing story about Dr. Reginald Archibald, who could have exploited and abused as many as hundreds of young boys during a nearly four-decade-long tenure at Rockefeller University and Rockefeller University Hospital. Archibald died in 2007. There are now issues around this that we are going to talk to Barbara Hart, who is on the line. Thank you for joining us. You are an attorney representing possible plaintiffs in a case, I guess, against Rockefeller University. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. Actually, I have several clients that unfortunately were abused by Dr. Archibald.
Now, he died in 2007. When he died, the issues, the cases, the exploitation of children, the abuse, that was not known at that time. When did this become public?
It's just a terrible thing in that there were allegations dating back to the 1960s. Several of my clients were patients of his in the 1950s, and others are later on and could have been spared the whole trauma and really scarring experience of being molested as children by an entrusted and revered physician that their parents were bringing them to. And there's just this awful actual timeline involving very early investigations and allegations that went unheeded, and he was able to continue in his pedophilic, terrible behavior with these children. And the situation that we find ourselves in now is that, thank goodness, these survivors have worked so hard to change the law and have brought about the Child Sexual Abuse Act in New York State, which allows people that decades ago were abused as children 1 year to bring a lawsuit against their abuser. So I represent people that were abused in camps, on school trips, and of course, people that were former patients, quote-unquote patients, survivors of Dr. Archibald, who had this terrible modus operandi of abusing siblings. He would use one brother as a conduit to get the parents to bring the other siblings in. And if you can just imagine the mental torture that that causes for parents and siblings to look back on, and they've often never discussed it with each other until now that this investigation and this new law has passed. So I've kind of gone on a little bit, but...
No, please.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, you're representing, and again, as you say, a number of folks who are just plain folks. One of them is a retired NYPD sergeant. One of them, I believe, is a union shop steward. And they clearly have been carrying this around for a very long time. He stopped practice a number of years ago, I would imagine. And as I say, he died, 12 years ago. So the questions about what the institution that employed him what their obligations are. I know that in reading the story in the Chief, in the June 3rd issue of the Chief, the institution is claiming transparency and claiming to want to do the right thing. What is your take on that?
Well, they were faced with this change in the law that empowers survivors to step forward and vindicate, stand up for the kid they once were. You know, we look back on ourselves as 8, 10, 11-year-old children, and now as adults, which my clients are, they are all men in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who were abused by different people in positions of authority over them. And they're standing up for that child that they once were. So in the instance of Rockefeller University Hospital, because they were on notice and because he had taken photographs of these children naked, and there were medical records that established very inappropriate behavior even within the medical records, they undertook an investigation, and they've conceded that his behavior was abominable and, you know, molestation. And in fact, he used the auspices of the hospital and the prestige of Rockefeller University Hospital as an opportunity to see these children and to exploit them and their trusting parents. And so what we have are situations where the children, the 11 and 12, 7 years old in one instance, are now men in their 50s and 60s and 70s. And I actually represent an estate in one instance where the person succumbed to suicide and just lived with the trauma of having been abused over a course of years by a former marital priest. So the child sexual abuse law gives the right to anyone that was abused, and their claim would otherwise be time barred. So while the Archibald case is just a terrible scenario of thousands of siblings being abused, and it's just mind-blowing in its scope and that he did it for four decades, it's hardly alone in what we're going to see under this new law. And it's just important for people to get good advice, trusted advice, and to talk to someone, because you have only 1 year. If you suffered this trauma when you were a child, you have 1 year. So it starts in August of this year and it goes through August of next year. And you should talk to a trusted person about what your rights are and whether or not it's time for you to stick up for that child that you once were, that was exploited and was misled. I mean, these children were told it was medically necessary. The molestation was medically necessary. The priest sometimes told the children it was an expression of God's love. The mind manipulation of that young person is just a whole other dimension to the physical abuse that they suffered. And it's time for the adults now to stick up for the younger version of themselves and seek counsel. And that's what this law provides. In New York, we now have a one-year lifting of the statute of limitations. In New Jersey, the law was just signed by Governor Murphy, giving 2 years.
Let me slow this down, because what has happened in New York State as a result of this law is that for 1 year, anyone who is carrying around these memories and has had these horrible experiences can seek justice until August of next year. At which point, what happens? I'm not really clear. I understand on how this works.
Well, it's a very unusual situation where we have this thing called statute of limitations.
Right. I understand the statute of limitations, but yeah.
Right. So things are what's called time barred, right? They're stale. You can't bring the cause of action. Well, that has been lifted because survivors worked and worked and worked. And, you know, I almost feel that we have to honor all the work that those survivors did to change this law, because what we know is kids get abused. They try to tell somebody or they don't try to tell somebody because they have, you know, misdirected shame, and they put that shame on themselves when they did nothing wrong. They were abused. Or they try to tell someone and they're disbelieved. Oh, the doctor is just, you know, doing medical practice, or the priest loves you. How could you say that? Different responses that occurred among the adults that we look back on wincingly, right? Those were the wrong response. You listen to the child. You understand that the person is to be believed. But in many instances, the children never said what happened to them. So now, whatever happened as a child, however long ago it happened, you have 1 year to bring a claim, August 2019 to August 2020. You bring that claim within that year, and the statute of limitations is void for that 1 year. There's an urgency that people come to grips with this and get good advice, trusted advice.
We're talking with Barbara Hart, who is an attorney representing possible plaintiffs connected to this new law. And we've only got about a minute left. But at the heart of this, for listeners, is that for 1 year, ending in August of 2020, is that correct, Ms. Hart?
That's correct, yes.
So in August of 2020, you will not have this opportunity if you have... If you are seeking to, well, put it in your words, what is it that someone can and should do if they've had this experience? And we've got about 45 seconds.
Well, they can call me, and I promise them I will give free advice, and I am happy for them to end up speaking or retaining another lawyer. They should speak to a lawyer about what their rights are, and they should do it as soon as they can come to grips with it. I mean, I have one client who never told his late wife. He's a widower. He never told his late wife. I was the first person he told. I have other clients that, you know, were siblings abused by that doctor at Rockefeller University Hospital. They never told each other. They're just telling each other about it now, and they both suffered at his hands. So you need to talk to somebody and get good advice and stick up for the child that you once were, and honor the survivors who have fought to lift the statute of limitations by actually coming forward. We almost could have a whole societal reckoning, coming to terms with the fact that this is just a terrible tragedy that a lot of children have suffered, and we need to speak out against it, and people need to achieve accountability in court.
Barbara Hart,
we have 1 year to speak now.
Barbara Hart, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us this evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the show this evening. I want to thank our guests, New York City Central Labor Council Political Director Lucia Gomez and Attorney Barbara Hart, for joining us. Before we go, I've got a quick announcement. The Municipal Employees Housing Program holds a housing seminar for first-time homebuyers and for those refinancing their home on Wednesday, June 26th at 5:30 p.m. at Union Headquarters. To pre-register, call 212-815-1814. Remember, if you have any comments about today's program, please drop us a line at State of the Union, that's one word, at dc37.net. State of the Union at dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Manocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao. We'll be right back.